Abba Shaul said in his name, this is tradition two. We have a different tradition about what Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai would say. Abba Shaul said in his name, if all the sages of Israel were on one scale of the balance, and Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus also with them, and Rabbi Eliezer ben Arach on the other side of the scale, he would outweigh them all. Meaning, the second tradition we have is that Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai said, if all the sages of Israel, including Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus, the plastered cistern, were on one side of the scale, and Rabbi Eliezer ben Arach, the overflowing fountain, who we guessed would be creative, full of innovation, overflowing, were on the other side of the scale, he, Rabbi Eliezer ben Arach, the overflowing fountain, would outweigh all of them. Okay, two very different traditions about where Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai is placing his hopes. Today, we're going to follow tradition number two, the tradition in which Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai is placing his hopes in this student who is an overflowing fountain. We're going to discuss what sort of hope is that for Judaism of the future and see where that goes. I see a question in the chat. What do we make of the anonymous source versus the named one? Okay, that's a great question. There are different traditions of how to interpret a Mishnah where you have two different opinions, one named and one not named, about what the kind of correct memory of a statement is. Suffice it to say for today that those traditions are not consistent, and that for the sake of what we're doing, we're going to follow each of them in turn. Let's keep going. I want us to see a second place where Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai is talking, this time to his students, that might give us more of a feel for who Rabbi Eliezer ben Arach is. Rabbi Yochanan said to them, go forth and observe which is the right way to which a man should cleave. Meaning, and I'm going to loosely paraphrase here, what sort of character trait does someone need in order to live a good life? Rabbi Eliezer said, a good eye. Rabbi Yoshua said, a good companion. Rabbi Yossi said, a good neighbor. Rabbi Shimon said, foresight. Rabbi Eliezer said, a good heart. Okay? Rabbi Eliezer, the person we're following today, the overflowing fountain, when asked what does a person need to live a good life, he said, a good heart. Rabbi Yochanan said to them, I prefer the words of Eliezer ben Arach, meaning the answer of a good heart, for in his words, your words are included. Meaning a good heart covers all of those other character traits or other things that a person might have in order to live a good life. I want us to look at two questions right now. I want us to think about, first of all, what might it mean for someone to say what you need to live a good life is a good heart? What sort of character traits, what sort of way of being in the world does that person value? And secondly, is Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai correct? Does a good heart actually cover all of those other traits that the other students mentioned? Again, what sort of character traits might a good heart mean? What might that person value? And again, what is Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai actually right about a good heart, including all of those other things, including a good eye, a good companion, a good neighbor, foresight? I'm going to the chat. Susan Kaplan asked, are all these texts from Pirkei Avot? They are. So far, the two we've looked at are from Pirkei Avot. Naomi Bar-Yam asks a good question. What did heart mean at that time? Different organs have been attributed to different qualities at different times. And Shai Robkin is saying something similar. At that time, the heart was considered to be what we would call the mind. I want to caution us about that. What Shai Robkin said is indeed correct, But this was before a time where we had what I'll call the artificial division between the mind as a thinking organ and the rest of a person's sort of what I'll call inner life. Meaning, yes, it does mean the mind, but that does not mean the mind is an isolated, rational sort of force as opposed to emotional, spiritual, other sort of inner resources. Okay, Jackie Karen says compassion. Let's talk about this for a moment. A good heart. Certainly compassion, but I want us also to think about the heart as it's described in the Torah. The heart, yes, and Hannah Chassid just got us there, I think, kind and God-focused. Again and again, when God is angry at the Jewish people in the Torah, what does God say? God says that their hearts are not open. They have hardened their hearts, or their hearts are covered, uncircumcised. There is no way into their hearts. The heart is a center of connection, really, in the way that the Torah has it, and I think might also be for Rabbi Elazar ben Arach. Let's go to the second question for a moment. Oh, Lynn Casuto says something very interesting. The fountain moves water, heart moves blood. Let's go to the second question for a moment, because this is going to be important. This is going to be important in excavating, okay, why does the bet on Rabbi Elazar ben Arach not succeed? The second question is Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai's assertion that a good eye, a good companion, a good neighbor, and foresight. If you have a good heart, you will also have all of those. Is that correct? And what I want to offer right now is maybe, but not always. Let's look at these traits. If you think that a good heart includes all of the things that we might talk about in terms of a good mind, as well as emotional ability, a good eye, maybe, depending on what that means, ability to discern. Foresight, possibly. But what about a good companion? And what about a good friend? Those are things that actually, I think, do not automatically come to everyone who has a good heart. And those are things that are actually about people outside of yourself. Why does that matter? I want us to pay attention and go back one step to the metaphor that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai used in terms of evaluating his students, right? What does Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai say when evaluating his students? He says, if all of the sages of Israel were on one side of the balance, and this other student, Rabbi Elazar ben Arach, was on the other side, he would outweigh them all. Let's talk about this for a moment. Where is Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai metaphorically placing the prized student in relation to the others? And why does that matter? Let's take a look at the chat. I think that there are answers coming in. We have debate going on about whether Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was correct about those character traits. Great. Okay, Frank Kapik offers he can build on all others. I think that's really interesting. That is a way of saying, yes, we have this scale, but you have maybe this sort of crown piece. I think that that's the best possible interpretation of what Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai is doing there. And I think it might be indeed how he meant what he was trying to say. Amplifier, I like that word a lot. Josiah Wolf offers a different explanation. And I think this is the darker explanation, the one that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai doesn't necessarily mean, but for some reason seems to be the way that these stories develop, which is you are taking one student and you are separating them out from the others. You are literally putting them on the other side of the balance. right? If we have a scale and I'm saying everyone is on this side and you are on that side, you've been singled out. You are different. You are alone. That's going to matter for where we see Rabbi Elazar ben Arach's path taking him. Deborah asked, I was wondering if Rabban Yochanan is meaning to foster competition and othering with this metaphor. I think that's a really good question, and I think it's very hard to know. Different educators make different bets on what is going to make their students the best they can possibly be. And we know that there are classrooms in which the teacher makes a bet on, I will make the best students and the best future leaders, if they are all kind of vying with each other. I don't know if that's what Rabban Yochanan meant to do, but I think we'll see today that it is at least one possible outcome of what happened. Let's keep going. We're going to try to understand a bit more about who Rabbi Elazar ben Arach is and what happens to his path in the story. We're going to jump into a story from Avot de Rabbi Natan, in which Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai's son dies and Rabbi Elazar ben Arach, among all of his other students, come to comfort him. And I want us to ask ourselves the following questions as we look at these texts. The first is, how do we see each student here using Torah? What do they think Torah is meant to do? How do they use it? How do they think about it? And the other is, what sort of personality, what sort of insight do you get to Rabbi Elazar ben Arach's personality from these texts? Let's jump in. When Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai's son died, his students came to comfort him. Rabbi Elazar entered and sat before him, saying, Rabbi, may I say something to you? Rabbi Yochanan replied, speak. He told him, Adam had a son who died, and he accepted comfort. Where does scripture speak of his accepting comfort? As it said, Adam again knew his wife. So too, you should find comfort. He replied, is it not enough that I have my own troubles, that you remind me of the sorrows of Adam? Let's keep going. The students continue in this vein. Rabbi Yeshua entered and said to him, may I say something to you? He said, speak. He told him, Jove's sons and daughters all perished on the same day. We've raised the stakes here, right? We went from Adam's one son dying to all of Job's sons and daughters died, and yet he was comforted. You too should find comfort. Where does scripture speak of his accepting comfort? As it is said, the Lord gives and the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. He replied, is it not enough that I have my own troubles, that you remind me of the sorrows of Job? We're not going to look at this inside, but this continues for another two students. Let's talk about this for a moment. The students are attempting to use Torah to comfort their rabbi. They are obviously failing dramatically, right? Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai's reply is almost a little bit wry, right? You think I don't have troubles enough that you're coming and reminding me of other people's troubles now? You're not helping. Let's talk about this for a moment. How are the students using Torah? In their minds, what is Torah supposed to do? How do you look at Torah for guidance in life? These observations are not at all comforting. I agree, they do sound a bit like Job's friends. Yeah, not a lot of compassion, right? Not a lot of seeing Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai, not a lot of kind of making space for him. Sharon Perlman says they're using the at least method, which is not helpful and not empathy. I think that's certainly correct. I want us to note for a moment, all of these observations, I think, are spot on about the emotional shortcomings here. I also want us to note what the students' statements tell us about how they think about Torah. Right? What is Torah meant to do? Torah is meant to give you a model in these students' minds. It is a book of precedents. How do I know what to do in any given situation? I find someone in Torah who went through something similar. I copy and paste whatever their response was, I should do. right? It's an approach that is very much about precedent, that's about tradition, that is about, I am supposed to fit my life into a sort of format in order to be like those who came before me. That is what Torah offers. I want to read two responses here. Gil Rosen says, they think Torah gives you a pat answer to everything, but not necessarily a compassionate one. I think that's spot on. This sort of, okay, if I can find the precedent in Torah, then I know what my answer is. And Susan Kaplan says, while you can look at the Torah for stories that seem similar to you, the comforter, one has to look beyond them in order to make them timely and real. Great. And for that phrase, look beyond them, I would offer one has to also look at the person they are speaking to. And I think that's a shift that we'll see with Rabbi Elazar ben Arach. Let's take a look at that. Rabbi Elazar ben Arach entered. When Rabbi Yochanan saw him, he said to his servant, gather my clothing and prepare to follow me to the bathhouse. For Rabbi Elazar is a great man, and I shall not withstand him. Okay, let's just note what this implies. When you're in mourning, particularly during Shiva, you do not go to the bathhouse. You traditionally do not bathe. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai is indicating to his servant that he knows that after his encounter with Rabbi Elazar ben Arach, he will be comforted enough that he will be ready to take the first step out of the deepest mourning. What does that tell us? That tells us that there's a pre-existing relationship there, and there's a deep pre-existing trust. That colors the way we read that piece from Pirkei Avot that we saw before. In the second tradition, where Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai says that Rabbi Elazar ben Arach would outweigh them all, it seems that Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai is not just talking about intellect. He's talking about some sort of emotional, maybe pastoral ability that Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai is trusting in here as Rabbi Elazar ben Arach walks in the door. Let's take a look. Rabbi Elazar entered and sat down before Rabbi Yochanan. He said to him, I will give you an analogy. I want to warn us before we read this analogy inside of one thing, which is what Rabbi Elazar ben Arach is about to say is, I think, a theology that would not work for many, perhaps most people in the 21st century, but it does work for Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. I want us to pay attention to what about it works for Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. What is it doing that's different from the other students? He said to him, I will give you an analogy. This is like a man with whom the king has entrusted a deposit of some value. Each and every day that man would wail and moan, oy for the time that I will return this deposit in peace and fullness. So you, Rabbi, had a son. He studied Torah. Torah, prophets, writing, Mishnah, laws, and narrative. And he departed this world without sin. You should take comfort that you have returned your deposit in peace and fullness. Rabbi Yochanan said to him, Elazar, my son, you have comforted me the way people should comfort. Again, I don't think this is a theology or an analogy that would work for many people in the 21st century. And it does work for Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. I'm going to ask people to put answers in the chat. What about this works for Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai? What is Rabbi Elazar ben Arach doing differently? What is the different sort of framing that he's offering? How is he looking to Torah differently? Why does this comfort Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai when nothing anyone else said before comforts? Josiah Wolf says, this reminds me of the story of Buria having to tell her husband about their two sons who died on Shabbat. I think that's very similar to that. Susan Kaplan says, how it works for today, this type of framing shows empathy. Great. Okay, we're going to come back to that. Eileen Lipow says, he doesn't try to lessen the grief, but he gives him compassion. A.C. Shalman, our children do not belong to us, our non-text-based theological assertion. Frank Capick says it acknowledges the spiritual value of both the Father and the Son. I really want to pay attention to that. I think that matters so much here. What were the other students saying? The other students were saying, okay, you had a child. It's terrible that he died, but take comfort. You can have another one. That's a terrible thing to say. Rabbi Elazar ben Arach is coming in and he's saying, you had a son and he was wonderful. You had a son and he was wonderful. He was full of value. He was this priceless deposit that God gave you. And you were a good father, right? He's talking about how Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai studied with him and taught him. He's looking at Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, and yeah, Susan Kimmel puts this beautifully in the chat. He's saying, you loved him, and your relationship with him mattered, and he mattered. He was a wonderful boy, and you were a good father. I want us to pay attention to two things. First of all, it's a completely different way of thinking about human relationships. It's not, well, you have this father-son relationship. A father can have many sons. It's you had a relationship with a particular person that's irreplaceable. And that's very much what a person in mourning needs to hear. The second is, I think this is a fundamentally different way of looking at Torah, right? What's Rabbi Elazar ben Arach doing? He's not saying, well, here's a precedent, follow that precedent. He's saying, how can I create Torah that incorporates what I might know or have or think about God and the world and value, but base that around you, right? What does an analogy do? It centers the person who is living the experience. If we're talking about a plastered cistern versus an overflowing fountain, a plastered cistern, what is it? It contains water that has already fallen. If you want water, if you want Torah, you have to dip into it to get what's already been collected. What is the overflowing fountain doing? The overflowing fountain is creating. And I would say here, creating in response to the person that Rabbi Elazar ben Arach sees in front of you. Let's keep going. I want us to work through the next story relatively quickly, in order to, for the sake of time, but I want us to see this additional aspect of Rabbi Elazar ben Arach that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai seems to be pinning his hopes on. In what sort of future of Judaism are we talking about here? A phrase you have to know here is the design of the divine chariot. That is a sort of code phrase in rabbinic writings for mystical, esoteric aspects of the Torah that are not generally taught publicly. The sages taught, an incident occurred involving Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, who was riding on a donkey and was traveling along the way. And his student, Rabbi Elazar ben Arach, was riding behind him. Rabbi Elazar ben Arach said to him, my teacher, teach me one chapter in the design of the divine chariot. He said, have I not told you? And one may not expound the design of the divine chariot to an individual unless he is a sage who understands on his own accord, right? What's Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai saying to him? This is the sort of Torah that can't be taught. You either need to intuit it on your own, of your own understanding, or you can't. Rabbi Elazar ben Arach said to him, my teacher, allow me to say before you one thing that you taught me. Just want to note the sweetness here. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai says, this can't be taught. It has to come from you. And even so, Rabbi Elazar ben Arach is saying, well, anything that comes from me, I still got from you. There's a deep trust there. He said to him, speak. Immediately, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai alighted from the donkey and wrapped his head in a cloak in a manner of reverence and sat on a stone under an olive tree. Rabbi Elazar said to him, my teacher, for what reason did you alight from the donkey? He said, is it possible that while you're expounding the design of the divine chariot and the divine presence is with us and the ministering angels are accompanying us, that I should ride on a donkey? Meaning Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai says, I know you. I know what's going to happen if you start talking about this and it's going to be big. I'm ready. Immediately, Rabbi Elazar ben Arach began to discuss the design of the divine chariot and expounded. And fire descended from heaven and encircled all the trees in the field, and all the trees began reciting song. What song did they recite? Praise the Lord from the earth, sea monsters, moths, fruit trees, and all cedars, praise the Lord. An angel responded from the fire, saying, this is the very design of the divine chariot, just as you expounded. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai stood and kissed Rabbi Elazar ben Arach on the head and said to him, blessed be God, Lord of Israel, who gave our father Abraham a son like you, who knows how to understand, investigate, and expound the design of the divine chariot. Happy are you, our father Abraham, that Elazar ben Arach came from your loins. This is from the Talmud Bavli, Tractate Chagiga. Let's pay attention to this. I think it adds an additional layer onto what does it mean that Rabbi Elazar ben Arach is an overflowing fountain. He's a person who cares about Torah of the heart. He is a person who looks at another human being and can create Torah of compassion, Torah that responds to their particular circumstance. And he's also a person of deep intuition and spiritual insight, right? This sort of, he opens his mouth and there's fire and there's lightning and the trees are clapping their hands. It's a very particular sort of ability. I want to pause for a moment and I want us to pay attention. We know all of the things that are wonderful about this, right? We talked about it, full of empathy, full of compassion. We can understand why this sort of incredible divine revelation that comes from his teaching would be incredible. What might be the disadvantages to this, particularly at this moment in history? What do I mean by that? I mean, we're about to see a source where, at least on the surface, it seems that Rabbi Elazar ben Arach somehow fails. And we know the second tradition, or rather the first, we know the other tradition that actually what we need in this moment is the plastered cistern. So let's ask ourselves the question. We know everything that would be wonderful about this, the creativity, the overflow, the ability for the new. What might at this particular point in history, in the wake of the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, right at the beginning of this creation of a new form of Judaism, what might not be what the Jewish people need about Rabbi Elazar ben Arach at this moment? Okay, let's look at some answers. Mark Hoffman, can anyone make their own Torah? How do we determine whose Torah is real? Okay, great. You're overflowing. You're an overflowing fountain, but do you have any boundaries? Right? The plastered cistern is all boundaries. The overflowing fountain is no boundaries. Susan Kimmel says the people need consistency. Lauren Davis, possibly in the developing halakha, this is not the most effective way to establish exact rules. Great, we're going to come back to that word, to halakha. Catherine Clark, too much innovation is destabilizing. Great. I want us to note, by the way, I think that if you look at Judaism in the second half of the 20th century, both in America and in Israel, this is actually very much a debate that we saw playing out time and time again. In the wake of the destruction of the Holocaust, where does Judaism need to place its bets for the future? Is this a moment in the wake of destruction where we need to place our bets in the conservative, in memory, in trying to rebuild, or in creating something new? Let's take a look at this piece about Rabbi Elazar ben Arach and what happens to him. Rabbi Chabo said, this is from the Talmud Bavli, Tractate Shabbat, Masechet Shabbat. The wine of Phrygia and the water of Demoset deprived Israel of the 10 lost tribes. Interesting opening. What I want us to note about that for now is the 10 lost tribes are indeed the greater part of the Jewish people. There's something here that we're noting that draws them away, and it will be a lead into the story about Rabbi Elazar ben Arach being drawn away. Once Rabbi Elazar ben Arach happened to come there to Phrygia and to Moset, and he was drawn after them, and his learning was forgotten. When he returned, he stood to read from a Torah scroll and was supposed to read the verse, "This month shall be for you, Hachodesh hazeh lechem," and instead he read, "Have their hearts become deaf, Hacheresh haya libam." What are we talking about here? We're telling a story in which at some point Rabbi Elazar ben Arach leaves behind the rest of the rabbinic community and goes to Phrygia and to Moset, and somehow there forgets enough of his Torah learning that when he is called to stand before the Torah and read it, his reading skills have atrophied, so much so that he cannot read Hachodesh hazeh lechem, a verse, "This month shall be for you." In fact, the first mitzvah that we're given in the Torah, the mitzvah of Rosh Chodesh, and instead makes slight mistakes, mistaking a dalet for a resh, and reads Hecheresh haya libam, "Have their hearts become deaf." The sages prayed and asked God to have mercy on him, and his learning was restored. And this is what we learned in a Mishnah that Rabbi Nohorai says, "Exile yourself to a place of Torah and do not say that it will follow you. As if you are in a place of Torah, your colleagues will establish it in your hands, and do not rely on your understanding alone." What's this gloss here adding? This gloss is adding, okay, this is because he went off on his own. Let's remember at the very beginning the metaphor of the scales, right? If all of them were on one side and he was on the other, there's been a sort of isolation, loneliness to him from the very beginning. Perhaps that's why this happens. He goes off on his own, and you indeed cannot maintain your Torah learning without community. It was taught Rabbi Nohorai was not his name, but rather Rabbi Nechemia was his name. And some say that Rabbi Elazar ben Arach was his name. So now we have a tradition. The person who said this, "Exile yourself to a place of Torah," Rabbi Nohorai, who was that in fact? We have different traditions, but one tradition is that that indeed was Rabbi Elazar ben Arach speaking about himself in his own tradition. And why was he called Rabbi Nohorai? It was because he would illuminate manhir, the eyes of the sages in halacha. Okay, let's talk about the story version one, the version that I think is most, I don't want to say obvious, but the straightforward reading of this. Rabbi Elazar ben Arach, the overflowing fountain who has no boundaries, what happens to him in some way makes sense. The water overflows, and if there's no one else there to catch it, to maintain it, it will be lost. He loses his Torah learning such that he is no longer able to read. He comes back, his companions feel so bad for him that they pray to God. His Torah learning is restored, and he has this new chapter as Rabbi Nohorai, who goes on to be a teacher of halacha. That's story one. I want us, though, to pay attention to the words that he actually ends up reading from the Torah scroll, because I think they're important. What's the verse that he's supposed to read? He's supposed to read Hachodesh Hazeh Lechem. That's a famous verse. It's an important verse. It's the first, in fact, at least according to rabbinic understanding, halacha that we get in the Torah. So much so that we have Midrash asking, why does the Torah not just start there? And what does he read instead? He reads, "Have their hearts become deaf?" What might be going on here? Rabbi Elazar ben Arach, whose Torah is Torah, let's remind ourselves that's concerned about the heart, that wants a Torah that speaks to other human beings, that centers the person in front of you, might be coming back to the community and standing up and reading from the Torah scroll, but also yelling, "Can your hearts hear or not? Are your hearts open? Are you able to actually take in what this is all about?" He might essentially be standing there and yelling, "You want me to read this verse about halacha? First, pay attention to your hearts. Are your hearts hearts that are able to learn and to teach Torah? Are your hearts hearts able that are able to produce Torah that the people in front of you need?" And the great tragedy in that version of the story is what? It's that the sages around him have no idea what he's saying. They're fundamentally not able to understand. To them, it's gibberish. So much so that they think he's lost all of his ability to learn, and they just look at him and say, "God, have mercy on him. Someone help him." There's the postscript to this story, then, I think is interesting. Because who does Rabbi Elazar ben Arach become in the postscript to that story in that version? He becomes Rabbi Nehorai, who illuminates the eyes of the other sages in halacha. And I want to offer two different readings there. Again, two readings. One is Rabbi Elazar ben Arach recognizes that this is not a language that they're going to be able to speak. Someone in the chat mentioned, okay, this new world, it needs rules, it needs halacha. And Rabbi Elazar ben Arach might say, okay, I got up and I yelled and I spoke about hearts and they could not understand. Maybe I need to change the way that I speak. Maybe I need to start speaking a different language, and that's the language of halacha. And I think there are ways in which that is both a beautiful ending and a tragic one. What's beautiful about it? What's beautiful about it is that Rabbi Elazar ben Arach, who all his life has been placed on the other side of the scale, finally realizes that he will not be able to make anything happen if he is not speaking a language that the other sages can hear. And he goes on and he speaks that language, and there's an outcome, right? He illuminates their eyes. But there also is in that a great loss. Because this is a person who could create Torah that speaks to the person directly in front of him. And this is a person whose Torah could call down the divine presence of heaven. And now he's tested himself. He is speaking a language of rules and regulations that can do something and maybe it's needed in this moment, but cannot do everything that he did before. I want to leave us here with the question of, what do we make of this? What do we make of the end of Rabbi Elazar ben Arach? Is this a story of a happy outcome where someone learns how to be part of community and use their gifts to move the community where it can go right now? Or is it a story of great loss for the Jewish people? Because there was Torah that we just were not ready for. And Torah that perhaps in our fear, perhaps in our trauma, we were not able to take in. I don't think there's one answer to that. I think that both and all shades between them are true. But I also want to say that part of what we'll do as we move forward in the next few weeks is keep an eye out for Rabbi Elazar ben Arach's Torah. As I think, even though it will take time for the Jewish people to be ready for it, we'll see before our time here together is done that the Torah of the heart remains part of the vernacular of the Jewish people when we're ready for it.